Medicom Medical Publishers produces peer-reviewed reports and highlights on major medical meetings. We bring the Congress to the physician.
Welcome to this podcast. Today, I will be discussing six of the presentations that were held at the United European Gastroenterology Week, which was held from the 8th to the 11th of October 2022 in Vienna, Austria. Enjoy listening. So the first study I would like to talk about today is a study that investigated detection rates of pancreatic cancer. The study was performed by Dr. Nosheen Umar and his colleagues at the University of Birmingham in the UK. There is often only a very short period for curative surgery in pancreatic cancer, meaning it is vital that patients are diagnosed with the disease as early as possible to give them the best chance of survival, said Dr. Umar. In this retrospective study, Dr. Umar investigated records of 600 patients diagnosed with pancreatic cancer between 2016 and 2021 to determine if imaging signs of pancreatic cancer were missed. Undergoing imaging that does not diagnose pancreatic cancer and 3 to 18 months later being diagnosed with pancreatic cancer was termed post-imaging pancreatic cancer, or PIPC. CT and MRI images were independently reviewed by two radiologists to develop an algorithm that categorized the missed cases and identified the most likely explanation for PIPC cases. Results revealed that 7.7% of cases were categorized as PIPC and almost half of them were located in the pancreatic head. Missed opportunities to potentially avoid PIPC were identified in 36% of PIPC cases. In only 40.4% of cases, no abnormality could be detected on initial imaging. 26% of PIPC patients had imaging signs of pancreatic cancer that were not recognized and investigated further. In 10.6% of PIPC patients, imaging signs associated with pancreatic cancer, such as dilated bile or pancreatic ducts, were detected but were inadequately followed up. Pancreatic cancer is responsible for 95,000 deaths in the European Union every year and has the lowest survival rate of all cancers in Europe. Life expectancy at the time of diagnosis is just 4.6 months. We hope this study will raise awareness of the issue of PIPC and common reasons why pancreatic cancer can be initially missed, Dr. Umar concluded. Dr. Samer Alduri of the Sahlgrenska University Hospital in Sweden performed an evaluation of the immune response against SARS-CoV-2 after 2 and 3 doses of mRNA vaccination in patients with liver cirrhosis. Patients with liver cirrhosis have an elevated risk for adverse outcomes after a COVID-19 infection and have a markedly elevated COVID-19 related mortality. How well can these high-risk patients be protected by vaccination? Dr. Alduri and his team determined T-cell-mediated and antibody reactivity against the spike 1, S1 protein of SARS-CoV-2 among 48 cirrhotic patients and 39 healthy controls after 2 and 3 doses of an mRNA COVID-19 vaccine. SARS-CoV-2 specific T-cell reactivity was measured by induced levels of T-cell-derived interferon gamma before and after the first and second vaccination with an mRNA vaccine. Moreover, serum IgG antibodies against the receptor-binding domain of the spike protein were quantified by immunoassays after the first, second, and third dose of the vaccine. T-cell reactivity against S1 was significantly reduced in cirrhotic patients compared with healthy controls after the first and second dose of the vaccine, with a p-value below 0.001. Most, 68% of the patients, lacked detectable S1-specific T-cell reactivity after the first vaccination compared with 19% in controls, with a p-value of 0.003, and 36% remained without detectable reactivity after the second dose versus 6% in the controls, with a p-value of 0.009. The lack of T-cell reactivity was mirrored by lower levels of an anti-receptor-binding domain S1 IgG after the first and second vaccination. Impaired T-cell reactivity in cirrhosis remained after correction for potential confounders and was particularly pronounced in patients with advanced cirrhosis. Anti-receptor-binding domain S1 IgG levels, however, were increased significantly after the third compared with the second dose. Patients who were vaccinated and had a naturally acquired COVID-19 infection achieved the best T-cell reactivity, with significantly higher antibody levels compared with antibody levels achieved through three doses of vaccination alone. Thus, in serotic patients, protective immunity is achievable by reiterated COVID-19 vaccination and by hybrid immunity. Next, I would like to talk about a phase 3 study called Nordic, which investigated the benefit of colon cancer screening with colonoscopy. Professor Michael Bredhauer of the University of Oslo in Norway presented the results. The Nordic trial is the first randomized population-based trial to investigate the effect size that colorectal cancer screening by colonoscopy has on incidence and mortality of colorectal cancer. This magnitude of effect is important not only on an individual base for shared decision-making with a patient, but also for planning official screening programs. 95,000 healthy people between 55 and 64 years of age, randomized directly from population registries in the partaking countries of Norway, Poland, Sweden, and the Netherlands, to either receive an invitation for one colonoscopy screening or usual care that, according to Professor Bredhauer, meant no screening in the trial countries. Of the invitees, 42% participated in a colonoscopy. The presented analysis of the 10-year results could not include 9,780 patients from the Netherlands due to Dutch general data protection regulations. In terms of screening performance, it went very well. There was good bowel preparation for the vast majority of patients. Professor Bredhauer commented on the participants' characteristics. The screening colonoscopies did not lead to any deaths or perforations, and all 15 cases of major bleeding could be managed endoscopically. In the intention to treat population, the results for the primary endpoint of colorectal cancer incidence after 10 years revealed a cumulative colorectal cancer risk of 1.2% in those without screening compared with 0.98% in those in the invited group. This resulted in a risk ratio of 0.82, with a 95% confidence interval between 0.7 and 0.93, or a risk reduction of 18% with screening. Professor Bredhauer also presented the results of an adjusted per protocol analysis, not without underlining that these results are not as trustworthy as those from the intention to treat population. But they are still informative, because what you do or try to do is to estimate the effect if everybody had accepted the screening, he explained. The per protocol assessment showed an incidence of 1.22% on usual care and 0.84% with colonoscopy screening, leading to a risk reduction of 31%. As for the secondary endpoint of colorectal cancer mortality, the difference between groups was low, 0.31% for the usual care versus 0.28% for the invited group, with a non-significant risk reduction of 10%. In his summary, Professor Bredhauer further added that with regard to all-cause mortality, there was no difference between the two groups. Next, I would like to talk about a study that compared colectomy with ileostomy to no colectomy or colectomy with remnant colon in patients with primary sclerosing cholangitis. A retrospective cohort study explored the effect of proctocolectomy with ileostomy on transplant-free survival in patients with primary sclerosing cholangitis, or PSC. The study introduced colectomy as a time-dependent variable and corrected for known risk factors like age, sex, concomitant inflammatory bowel disease, IBD, or autoimmune hepatitis, and enrollment in a tertiary center of care. The trial enrolled 1,341 adult patients from the EPI-PSC2 cohort between 2008 and 2021, leading to over 14,000 patient years of follow-up. The mean age at PSC diagnosis was 39 and 64% were men. Most patients had large duct PSC, 86%, and 68% had been diagnosed with IBD. Most of the observed colectomies were indicated by dysplasia or neoplasia or active colitis. During follow-up, the median transplant-free survival was about 19 years. We observed 370 liver transplants and almost 400 deaths, of which PSC-related deaths were most common in this group, said Dr. Brechemol of the Amsterdam UMC in the Netherlands. Comparison between no colectomy, colectomy with remnant colon, or proctocolectomy with ileostomy showed a protective effect of proctocolectomy with ileostomy with regard to liver transplantation and PSC-related death, with a hazard ratio of 0.47 and a 95% confidence interval of 0.24 to 0.93. For other forms of colectomy with residual colon, no benefit was found. Interestingly, IBD status of the patients had no impact. In our data, PSC with ileostomy seems to be associated with a better transplant-free survival, which points towards a role of the colonic microbiota in the disease course of PSC. That is, because you only see this effect when you perform a colectomy with ileostomy, so no colonic microbiota can remain, and this effect was not seen with any remnant colon function, Dr. Moore concluded. The fifth study I would like to talk about today is the phase 3 EOE Kids trial, which investigated dupilumab in children with eosinophilic esophagitis. In the phase 3 Liberty EOE TREET trial, dupilumab demonstrated already clinically meaningful improvements in histological, symptomatic, and endoscopic outcomes in adolescents and adults with eosinophilic esophagitis, or EOE. As a result of this trial, the Food and Drug Administration, FDA, recently approved dupilumab as the first and only agent for treatment of adults and children 12 years and older with EOE. The Phase 3 EOE Kids trial aimed to evaluate the efficacy, safety, and tolerability of dupilumab versus placebo in pediatric patients aged 1 to 11 years with active EOE. All included participants had failed to respond to proton pump inhibitors. The study consists of three parts. In the double-blind part A, 102 participants were randomized 1:1:1 to two doses of dupilumab or placebo and treated for 16 weeks. In part B, all participants will be offered dupilumab, and part C will be an open-label extension period up to 108 weeks. For this presentation, I will focus on the primary outcomes at week 16, especially from the high-dose group, and please keep in mind that parts B and C are ongoing, explained Professor Evan S. Dellen of the University of North Carolina School of Medicine in Chapel Hill in the USA. All participants had to have baseline esophageal biopsies with a peak intraepithelial eosinophil count above 15 eosinophils per high pyrophilic in at least two of the three esophageal regions, but there was no symptoms threshold to be included. At week 16, 68% of participants treated with a higher dupilumab dose and 58% with the lower dose achieved the primary endpoint, a peak esophageal intraepithelial eosinophil count of 6 or lower than 6 eosinophils per high pyrophilic, compared with 3% with placebo, with a p-value below 0.0001. Dupilumab was also superior to placebo in a couple of secondary endpoints, such as the reduction of peak esophageal intraepithelial eosinophil counts at week 16 from baseline. This parameter was reduced by 86% in the higher dupilumab dose group and increased in placebo by 21%, with a p-value below 0.0001. The high-dose dupilumab regimen reduced histologic scores at week 16. Regarding clinical symptoms, a numeric improvement was seen in the dupilumab group. Participants in the dupilumab group gained 3.09 kilos in weight compared to 0.29 kilos in the placebo group. Although this difference failed to reach statistical significance, this is what Professor Dellen described as a substantial increase in body weight, almost a normalization. The rate of adverse events and treatment discontinuation due to adverse events prior to week 16 was higher in the placebo group compared with the dupilumab group. Finally, I would like to talk about a study by Professor Ajit Sirivardhana of the Manchester Royal Infirmary in the UK, who investigated procalcitonin-based algorithm to help spare antibiotics in acute pancreatitis. International guidelines do not recommend the use of antibiotics in acute pancreatitis in the absence of specific infections. However, globally, there is an overuse of antibiotics in all forms of acute pancreatitis, mainly because of the difficulty in distinguishing between a systemic inflammatory response and infection. Normal physiologic levels of procalcitonin, or PCT, are low, but they rise rapidly in response to infection and fall after eradication. Thus, PCT can distinguish infection from inflammation, and algorithms based on procalcitonin measurement can differentiate bacterial sepsis from a systemic inflammatory response. Therefore, Professor Sirivardhana and his team tested in the PROCAP trial whether a procalcitonin-based algorithm to guide initiation, continuation, and discontinuation of antibiotics can reduce antibiotic use in patients with acute pancreatitis without an adverse effect on outcome. In the single-center, patient-blinded, randomized controlled trial, adult patients with acute pancreatitis were included and randomly assigned to either a procalcitonin-based algorithm guiding antibiotic use in addition to usual care or to usual care only. Moreover, patients were stratified according to disease severity and admission pathway. In total, 260 patients were randomized, 132 to PCT-guided treatment and 128 to standard of care. If the clinicians wanted to use antibiotics and the PCT result was below 1.0 micrograms per liter in the intervention group, it was recommended that no antibiotics were started or patients already treated with antimicrobial therapy should stop it. Only in patients with PCT results of 1 or more micrograms per liter, an antibiotic intervention was recommended. Significantly fewer participants in the intervention group used antibiotics compared with the control group, 45% versus 62%, with a p-value of 0.0077. In addition, there were fewer days of antibiotic use in the intervention arm compared with usual care. Regarding the number of clinical infections or hospital-acquired infections, there was no significant difference between the two groups. In addition, mild and severe disease and admission pathways did not influence the results. Costs were markedly reduced by applying the PCT-based algorithms. Our findings suggest that procalcitonin-guided care can reduce antibiotic use without increasing infection or harm in patients with acute pancreatitis, Professor Sirivardhana concluded. Therefore, a PCT-based algorithm should be considered in the care of patients with acute pancreatitis and be incorporated into future guidelines.
This podcast was produced by Medicom Medical Publishers.